It's exhausting. I get it.
Their dick is their also the size of their wallet. So they're like, look at it. Yeah. Look how rich and giant it is.
I am the peak of man. It's like,
yeah, exactly.
Hi, I'm Gabe.
And I'm Kat.
And we're
the Ghouls Next Door.
Talking about spooky stuff.
Yes. As we, as this is expected of a Ghouls Next Door.
The supreme Ghouls Next Door.
Yeah. Have you seen our business cards?
We should get some really nice business cards.
Yeah.
We are the Media Literacy Show from a Horror Lens, where we explore the real-life, historical, and capitalistic influences behind our cinematic fears. And today, closing out our Horrors of Society episode, we are going to, or series, Horrors of Society series, with a final episode about American Psycho.
Yeah, and like, what a time this film was. It was more comedic than horrifying.
Yeah.
And I think that's what made it fun. And I think that's what it was trying to do. Like, it was like, look at this horrible thing that society does. But also, look at this ridiculous man.
So funny.
You know?
I usually, when it comes to, like, big horror or big films that are cult classics that everyone loves, I tend to come in a little more skeptical. And usually... We've historically not liked films just because everybody else likes them. Mm-hmm. I will say I really like American Psycho. I was having a good time the whole time. I think this is one of my favorite films. I'm going to be honest. I was like, wow, this is so absurd and hilarious.
What a riot. Yeah.
I love that this thing was made so that we can laugh at these problematic men. Like, that's so exciting for me. I'm like, we don't get to do that in a safe environment ever. We don't get
that's
to laugh.
That's super valid. Yeah.
And well, this is designed for that.
In a toxic masculine space is very dangerous because they take themselves very seriously.
Yeah.
So to be laughed at is not allowed. Mm-hmm. But the movie, when you're in your house, you're allowed.
Yeah.
It's a good time.
And like, Aaron was intending for us to laugh. Like it was all so absurd with the intention to make you laugh. And that was beautifully done. It's so good. In my section, I will talk about some fans are doing it wrong. You know, This film is one of those that has been misinterpreted or just like the point goes right over someone's head. And it's like, how do you get to a point where you think I want to be this guy?
Well, that's the whole, okay, when I get to my section, the whole thing is the socialization of white men in America is to be this man.
Yeah.
And that's why a lot of the point is like missed, but also like the entire idolization of him is why a commentary needed to exist in the first place. It's such a wild experience. I've met many men who literally, specifically in high school, I haven't really met any adult men who idolize Patrick Bateman in real life.
I don't bump elbows with those types.
Yeah, but in high school, I vividly remember multiple individuals who were like, I love that guy. His whole thing, I want to be that. And I'm like, you're terrifying.
You were the joke. You're the punchline.
Yeah,
the joke.
So scary.
But I mean, that. Yeah, they are. I think it's a piece that, you know, can contribute to some of the themes that it's trying to critique, because like in that way, also with the intense violence that occurs, like you at some point you are just contributing as well. But I think it's also just a valuable piece of cinema. It's also, you know, it takes place in the 80s and it's supposed to be commentary on 80s specific consumer culture, but it's not super far-fetched from what we like. We are very much in this, and I just think of a new version of this would include like Bateman having extensive cryptocurrency, you know?
Yeah.
He would definitely be invested in Bitcoin and would idolize what's his name? Elon Musk.
Oh, for sure. It's fun. I don't know, because I know Trump gets mentioned a lot in the movie and in the book, apparently, in a kind of like fixated fashion.
Yeah.
That I don't know if like what Musk was doing when this was written, but I guess he just wasn't as much in the limelight. No. But yeah, I agree. If it was like repurposed to be now, it would be like Musk, Bezos.
Yeah.
Zuckerberg on the list of people who are like, heck yeah, let's make industry towns. We love it.
Yeah. Yeah. And just like, I think Musk really benefits from a very specific persona that he puts out that's completely false. And it's exactly this, right? It just so happens that he's the one who went forward with it. He's just such a good liar that people believe him. And that's exactly what Bateman is. It's, yeah, I think it's such a fascinating film. And I get it. You know, it's one of those where I'm like, okay, yeah. All right, I'll let people like it.
Yeah.
It's good. Yeah, let's hop in because I got a lot to say about it.
Say the words.
So as we said, we're talking about American Psycho, which is from 2000, the year 2000. We don't often cover things that far behind. Like early 2000 things were like, wow, this is silly. This is old.
Or this is so relevant. So bad, and that didn't happen.
Yeah.
As bad here, yeah.
Like, besides the absurd technology, like the gigantic phones, you could swap at, like, this movie could exist at any time.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of sad, but it's the truth. So American Psycho is about a wealthy New York City investment banking executive, Patrick Bateman, hides his alternate psychopathic ego from his coworkers and friends as he delves deeper into his violent hedonistic fantasies. It's directed by Mary Harron. And it is a brilliantly satirical and comical view at the toxicity of consumerism and masculinity and materialism and just everything.
Yeah.
there's so many things I could talk about. And I was like, I need to slim this down. But Mary Harron's film is an adaptation of Bret Easton Ellis's controversial novel of the same name and has very similar vibes. It's I think the only thing where Harron felt she went a little different was the ending, which inspired people to have a different point of view of the fit, like the story.
Yeah.
And she's like, oops.
And also just like the lens too.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Well, so Christian Bale plays Patrick Bateman, and it is said that he was heavily inspired by the insincerity of Tom Cruise. And while I was looking up images to replicate for our visual viewers, I found this one image and I was like, you can't tell me that's not Tom Cruise. Like, I'm pretty sure that this is just an image of Tom Cruise. Like, I don't get Tom Cruise fascination. I always feel that he's disingenuous in that way. Like, I don't get it. I don't get him. I don't get his films. I don't, none of it. People are like, oh, have you seen us? No. Yeah. Haven't seen any of the 10 impossible missions he's been on. I don't know.
I think it's because of like the ingenuineness of his emotions sometimes. It's like there's a fascination with just like how you be like this, you know? Mm-hmm. You're just like, I cannot fathom why.
He also has that, like, he has very Bateman qualities to him in that he envisions himself as a very specific human and tries to impose that image on everybody else. Like, he wants to be seen and believed to be a very specific person of power and height, including like the way that they shoot films to make him seem taller, because he's just so insecure in his own like personhood, which could be tied to, you know, just the fact that he's been a celebrity for so long, also his religion. There's a lot of money.
Yeah.
So it seems very truthful that it would be inspired by Tom Cruise. Not even just like insincerity. Like, I think Bateman and Tom Cruise are pretty close.
Yeah.
To just have different careers.
There's just like chaos about him. That's fascinating, I guess, too.
There's like an unhinged, like, understanding of the world.
From the fire, you know?
Yeah. You're like, what are you doing?
Yeah.
Wow. So the film follows Bateman, a successful Wall Street investment banker by day who leads a sinister double life as a sadistic serial killer by night. And as we spend time with the baffling mind of Bateman, we find that beneath his polished exterior lies a deeply disturbed individual who embraces violence as a means of asserting dominance and control. It's his whole thing. Heron is absolutely hilarious, creating the blurred world for Bateman that has him unable to distinguish between his graphic fantasies and his toxic life of wealth and vanity. But she also designs a world of people so engrossed in their own identities and status, they are blind to the violence and harbored thoughts of a psychopath seated across from them. Yeah. Everyone in this movie is a problem. Yes. Besides the one houseless individual that gets murdered and the sex workers. Yeah. Like everybody else, there's a problem. Even Willem Dafoe.
Because they like facilitate his time and they like consciously and unconsciously just ignore all the red flags. He just seems like a nice guy.
They couldn't be bothered to pay attention.
Yeah.
You know, they're too busy. They're too busy creating.
Well, because you can't be yourself, so you have to, everyone's like, no one can see the thing underneath of this, so
yeah,
can't look at anyone else's either.
And you know, as we were saying in the beginning, American Psycho is very much like Fight Club in that it has some of the most misguided fans, in those folks who've missed the point entirely, right?
Yeah.
One day we will cover Fight Club and Chuck Palahniuk because I do actually really enjoy his work. But I've always wanted to discuss how like a story written by a gay man that is an obvious critique on toxic masculinity can be so completely misunderstood that men go as far as labeling themselves as like Tyler Durden-esque people on dating apps. Yeah. Like that's not an advertisement you want to be making.
Yeah.
He was the pro, like, what are... The same could be said about the people who idolize American Psycho, where men leap entirely over the point and land on this is my identity now, idolizing the problematic and laughably absurd masculine monster that is Patrick Bateman.
Yeah.
And actually, I saw this like one random interview with Bale where he mentioned it was like uncomfortable for him when fans like were idolizing Bateman because he's just like, well, why? Like, yeah. Why do you idolize this monstrous idiot? Like, he's so ridiculous. And he was like, I don't think you get it. Which is also really funny that Christian Bale is saying that because
he's not exactly a pillar of...
Yeah, he'd be yelling at people you don't need to be doing. Yeah, yeah. That's why I was like, I didn't ever think I would like a thing Christian Bale was in either. I did like the mechanics, but anyway. Yeah. But for those of us who got the point, like properly, American Psycho is a brilliant feminist film in some ways, right? Bateman is so excruciatingly pitiful, socially inept and pathetic. We can roll our eyes alongside the sex workers just doing their job to catch a bag. We can smirk at his exhaustive morning skincare routine, his excessive grooming, and deliberate clothing choices he makes with the intent of convincing us and himself of the very manly man that he is.
Yep.
It's exhausting for all of us involved, including him. And it's an ideology that is harmful even to himself. And we can even go as far as understanding the confusion between him and another coworker, like mistaking him for someone else, because all of these men are the same and they are all the vice president.
Yeah.
I just can't. Like, how do you not know this is a joke?
Yeah.
I don't get
Everyone's
it.
Everyone's president. Everyone gets
you tired, can't all, you we know? Can't all, like, we were watching, I was like, we cannot all be vice president. That's not how that works.
Yeah.
So Patrick Bateman and his Wall Street colleagues are in a constant pursuit of the latest fashion, high-end dining experiences, and status symbols. And each man is void of their own personality, defined only by their status and the items they surround themselves with, which sometimes those items are their pretty blonde women.
Yep.
Right? They are indistinguishable from the next, if not for their specific suit or access to exclusive restaurants, which is, again, this hierarchical thing, right?
Yeah.
The meticulous attention to detail regarding fashion labels, business cards, and even the superior taste in music becomes a reflection of their identities and a way to establish dominance over one another. I'm better than you because I like Huey Lewis in the News. Sidebar, Gabe hates Huey Lewis in the News. I cannot stand them. It's the worst music ever. So I was like, okay, I get it. I know who this guy is. Status is such a crippling obsession to Bateman that all of his decisions are wrapped in the pursuit of elevation, caught in an endless dick measuring contest. That's every day. Yep. That it's what he is. It's exhausting. I get it.
Their dick is there also the size of their wallet. So they're like, look at it. Yeah. Look how rich and giant it is.
I am the peak of man. It's like,
yeah, exactly.
One of the best scenes in arguably all of cinema is the infamous business card scene. It's a brilliant example of the absurd lengths these characters go to for superiority. The laughably absurd severity of focus on the color, font, and weight of the business card highlights their shallow preoccupation with appearances and the desperate need for validation. It's when that scene came on and they're like, check out this new business card. And it's like everyone was the same, except like one was like a different font. Maybe like slightly, like I was like, mine is ivory, but mine's eggshell. And I was like, this is like when you're wedding dress shopping.
Yeah.
You know, and you're very specific about the linens or something.
Yeah.
Like, I was like, I can't tell the difference, but this I did see that everyone
picture.
Was.
Yeah.
Yes. everyone's a vice president. I was like, you cannot, what is this company? And they were in mergers and acquisitions, which is just essentially the same as the severance company.
Yeah.
So, but what is mergers and acquisitions? What is that? What are you doing? Nothing. You're not doing anything.
Yeah.
The film confronts our own obsession with status and the exaggerated portrayal of these wealthy monsters. But do we not see some truth in them? They're exaggerated, sure, but also not.
Yeah.
Like, I can believe there's some men out there who feel very strongly about business cards and their skincare routine. We're left questioning whether consumerism has become the new religion where people worship brands and possessions rather than seeking genuine connections or personal growth and leaving husks of humans in their wake because none of them were an actual person. Through the film's violence, we find an expression of frustration and a release from the pressures of consumer-driven society. Bateman's murderous tendencies, seemingly driven by his dissatisfaction with the world around him, represents a darker consequence of a society that values superficiality above all else. It's a cry for help.
Yeah.
And he doesn't even know he's doing that, right? It's hurting him so much that he has to act out in some way to feel relevant.
And it's like fueled by his own like sense of superiority also, like the people he chooses.
Yeah. And it's like it's a confliction of superiority, but also feeling like he is inferior, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like he's constantly fighting. Like, why don't you know? Like he's so at odds with the rest of the world. That's like, who are you? No one even remembers your name. You look like the seven other men in this room.
Yeah.
This picture is the same.
Yeah.
This is the same picture.
He's like, I'm unique.
Yeah. He's like, but I'm Patrick Bateman.
Because I murder, you know?
Yeah.
That's the different thing I do.
Newsflash. You're all murdering the lower class.
Yeah.
And you kill houseless populations all the time.
Yep.
His acting out is the destructive nature of unchecked consumerism, and it shows the lengths to which individuals might go to escape the monotony and hollowness of their lives and identity. And in a twisted way, Bateman's acts of violence become a rebellion against a world that has reduced humanity to mere commodities. And each part of his intricately designed persona and existence is with specific intention to be something he can never actually be. Right. Or like that he believes he already is. He's just trying to convince everyone else to catch up. Right.
Yeah.
And he has left humanity behind and become a commodity himself, unable to connect with other humans in any genuine way. He has separated himself so severely from reality and his own self that he views his life like a film. That's why he's narrating it to us. Like he's so detached from his actions. It's like, oh, look, I'm just watching this beautiful film. He's like, all the fans here are stupid about it.
Look at me flex my muscles as I murder things.
Yeah. Checking myself out as I have sex. This is so ridiculous. The relentless pressure to conform to societal expectations of success, power, and dominance leaves no room for vulnerability or emotional expression, which is why I think it also exposes the emotionally stunted nature of toxic masculinity and the toll that it takes on individuals' mental and emotional well-being. In his constant pursuit of being the best and most important person in the room, he has to sacrifice just being a human, just existing in his own emotions and feelings, because there's no room for that in the conference room.
Mm-hmm.
Right. That's why even the business cards are completely devoid of personality. Yeah. You can't have one of those. So, and even in his sexual exploits are influenced by the violent nature of the porn that he watches as he works out. Like, even when he's having sex and intercourse, those are all an interpretation of what is supposed to happen. Right. Yeah. He's performing what he has seen happen before. It's not actually an authentic experience for him. It might not even bring him any joy to do those things. It's just, that's what I saw being done.
Yeah.
And so I'm doing it. Yeah. The same thing with like the women that he collects. Everyone wants this kind of woman. I now have that.
Yeah.
He doesn't care.
So everyone else will like me more because I have achieved this like pillar of what it is to be man.
He like wants nothing.
Yeah.
He like act like his own desires is just non-existence. It just must achieve greatness, right? Must be important. This goes even as far as, you know, like I said, with the women in his life, much like the men, are objects to be used to work towards the perfect life he believes himself deserving of. And he's so obsessed with his own appearance that during the sex scene, he's more captivated by his own body than those he's with. And mm-hmm. he also fabricates entire stories, right? He supplants an idea in history with these people he's interacting with, like they are even performers in his life.
Yeah.
In like in each of his interactions with other humans, he is inauthentic and smug, and he imposes his superiority on them by inquiring on their knowledge about arguably completely mundane music and impresses upon them his own importance and status. But while he, as narrator, insists on his own importance, we are inundated with interactions that paint him as forgettable and dismissed. No one at all around him knows who he is or cares. And yeah. So everyone around him may be a tool to him, but to everyone, he's nothing.
Yeah.
And that's really like the whole point of the film. So I want to get into some explicit spoilers about the film. Like, we know he's a murderer. We know he kills people. We know what's going on. The mm-hmm. ending is one that's pretty notorious for being a little vague or being a little surprising, and so I will talk about it because yeah. I was confused from my memory of when I first saw it, and yeah. then I was watching it this time and I was like, wait, I don't know if that's true, and then I found the answer and I'm really excited about it. So
yeah.
If you haven't seen this film from 2000, go watch it. Super funny. It does have a lot of violence, and that was jarring for some viewers when it first premiered.
Mm-hmm.
But I feel like it's so graphic and absurd, like as graphic and absurd as like his personality, that it's like also funny. Like, and some of it's not. Some of it's like, oh my God, that's horrible. But I feel like there's just so much of it that's like, you're like, what? This guy's ridiculous.
Yeah, some of the murders are very over the top too. Like, it's not like,
yeah.
it's a kind of nonsensical way to murder someone. Like the... Mm-hmm.
Like the methods, yes,
exactly. It seems nonsensical. So, like, those ones, although very brutal, were like, you're like, how would that even happen? How mm-hmm. no one react to this? Like, no one comes out in the hallway and's like, hey, maybe don't do that.
But of course they don't. Of course they don't. No one's looking outside of their lives.
Yep.
You know, and that's again, that's the whole point. It's so genius. It's such a great film. So yes, there's violence. You can absolutely like close your eyes to avoid yeah. it and get the gist of like he murdered a bunch of people. But if it's not your cup of tea, you can listen to this spoiler version here to know what happens at the end and what the gist of the story is. And then you did it. Mm-hmm. Now you know why this is a cult classic and everyone loves it. Let's talk about the end of the film and the through line of his monstrosity. And in the film, Bateman has an upsetting interaction with Jared Leto. I mean, Paul Allen. I was like, it's just like Jared Leto, though. Everyone would want to kill him as well. And Paul Allen confuses him for another man who, in Allen's defense, looks just like him.
Yep.
And further, Bateman explains the mistake is understandable. It happens often. And it's understandable because both of these men do the same job and are essentially the same in every way that counts. They mm-hmm. like wear the same kind of suits. They have the same job. They work in the same place. They go to the same places outside of work. Like, he was like, I get it. But also he was insulted. So this exchange, coupled with Alan's superior question mark business card unleashes a rage in Bateman that has him using Alan's confusion to his disadvantage, or to Bateman's advantage. He invites Alan out to dinner as Halberstrom, who's the guy he thought he was. After many drinks, he brings him back to his apartment that is now covered in plastic sheets and newspaper. But Alan is too intoxicated and so secure in his own status in the world that it doesn't occur to him that he'd be in danger. He's like, why are the funnies on the ground? Why's the sports section over there? He's like, yeah,
no one could
want to
kill me. I'm just the white man. The white man. No one wants to harm the white man.
The white man in power. Like, never. Yeah. It just, like, danger is not a concept.
And if they do, the consequences will happen. And they don't.
Yeah. 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 No one would ever dare to do that because I'm so important. But he's also unimportant.
Yeah.
So Bateman murders him and works to cover it up. He sneaks into Alan's apartment and leaves a new voicemail message about Alan leaving for London. Totally believable. Also laughably, it's just his voice. Like, again, they were just so indistinguishable that he could just pretend to be Alan. And it's like, everyone's like,
yeah, that's him. Yep, that's his voice. Sure.
Eventually, he begins using Alan's apartment, which is far nicer than his own, I guess. It looks the same to me, for his other desires, which is murder, sex, and status. So the ending, as I had first interpreted it, was that Bateman had imagined all of this violence and chaos, that he was so wrapped in his own potential and selfish being that he believed himself to be capable of these horrifying acts. But in reality, he is pathetically simply someone with a great imagination.
Yeah.
And that's like one that most people kind of, or a good number of people lean towards, because it does seem like, because everyone's like, what are you talking about? None of this has happened. All your stuff is erased. And you're like, oh, then maybe it didn't happen. However, thanks to YouTuber Alaric's films and their video American Psycho, A Message on Consumerism, I have found that that is not the case. And this is way more interesting and a testament to what Heron was trying to say, you know, and her genius. So Heron actually mentioned that it was her approach to the end that has inspired these interpretations. She had hoped that the end would be vague and left to interpretation and lean more towards what happened in the book. But because of some of the decisions that she, the creative decisions she made, people are like, oh, it was all made up.
Yeah.
And she's like, no, dang it.
Yeah.
That's not what you're supposed to think, you idiots. I'm sure there's a few things where she's like, how did you guys get there?
Yeah.
Alaric's films explain the truth of that perplexing ending, and it was very helpful. I do recommend going and checking out that video because he plays the clips from the film, so you can see like actually what's going on.
Yeah.
So in the end, after a descent into true madness, Bateman goes on a killing spree, which results in him like shooting up police cars and trying to feed a cat into an ATM machine. It's like, it's clearly insane. Like, you're like, this is made up, or so, like, this is a break for him. Like,
yeah.
Like a mental snap, because there's no way this is happening. But something has happened where now he finds himself, you know, in his office, cover, like taking cover from the helicopters outside, and he calls his lawyer and leaves a message admitting to all the horrors that he's committed. He's like sobbing, he's finally questioning his own sanity and if he's a good person. He's just like, oh my god, I'm a monster, help me clean it up.
Yeah.
It's not really like oops, it's like I'm gonna keep doing it. Right. But after this harrowing night where he's unscathed, nothing bad happens to him, he finds his lawyer at this event, and he is at first mistaken for someone else entirely. Like, the lawyer doesn't even know who he is. He's unforgettable, right? And when he explains, no, I'm Patrick Bateman, he's laughed off for his absurd joke. It was like, oh, you really have me going.
Yeah.
And Bateman tries to convey the truth of the matter, but is continually dismissed. You know, they're like, this isn't a joke. Like, why do you keep making this a joke? And the lawyer explains that he'd actually seen Alan recently in London. So he couldn't possibly be dead. And this is an idea that the detective, Willem Dafoe, of the case shared previously.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an idea that is heavily influenced by Bateman's message on Alan's phone. So he left that message saying, I'm going to London for a few weeks, and everyone believed it. So then we saw a guy vaguely looks like Fallon in London a few weeks ago, it had to have been him. Yeah. Because no one matters. No one knows who anyone is. Yeah. So, panicked, Bateman runs to Alan's apartment, where he had been storing the gruesome corpses of his victims. It was a murder capital the night before, where it was just splattered blood on the walls. It was just like, it was horrifying. It was like a haunted house of horrors for the last victim running out of there. Mm-hmm. But when he gets there, the apartment is immaculate. Pristine white walls and a chipper real estate agent are there instead of blood and regret. And we would then be led to believe none of what we've seen has happened, because like everything's cleaned up. So he's clearly insane, right? He thought there's blood everywhere and he was doing murder, but this whole time he didn't even get into the apartment. Right. Yeah. But instead, if we consider that Alan's family was investigating his disappearance and keeping it under wraps, that's what the detective says. Like, oh, his family's concerned, but we're keeping this on the down low. We could understand that perhaps the family discovered the violent aftermath and thought it was committed by Alan.
Yeah.
Right? He's very capable because he's terrifying white man with power.
Yeah.
So instead, they would think that his disappearance is a result of him fleeing the scene of the crime, not just going off, right?
Yeah.
So they would then clean up his mistakes and move on like it never happened.
Yeah.
Right? To cover his tracks. So then this leaves even this, the only act that was truly Bateman's, to be erased and rewritten as someone else's. Mm-hmm. Even his villainy is not his own, as he is condemned to forever be mistaken for someone else, so terribly forgettable and unoriginal that no one will remember his name.
Yep.
And I think it's such a bittersweet, like, ending that was well-deserved, so.
Oh, 100%. And it's like, I see, when you were like, oh no, it just, none of it's real, I was like, what do you mean? Of course the white man got away with it. So it's just like, yeah, really funny to me. I totally agree with that YouTuber. I didn't see the video, but that, the 100%.
I just remember him sketching the, like, I misremember, because doesn't he sketch on like a napkin when he's out at dinner?
Yeah, with Reese Witherspoon's character. Yeah,
and he's like sketching horrible things. And I was like, okay, clearly this is all in his head because someone would have noticed that. And that's just totally on me. Thinking that these people are at all aware of the world around them and not in of themselves, to be able to notice that. But that's the whole point, was that it's no one cares so hard that he can do something like that in the restaurant. So
yeah, like they're socialized to ignore all of his like red flag behaviors because, well, Reese Witherspoon's character specifically is benefiting off of their arrangement.
Mm-hmm.
Even in her crying when he breaks up with her, she immediately stops crying in very typical white woman fashion, where she's like, all right, that wasn't real, all right, the show's over.
Yeah, I got my attention. I got to be the victim.
Yeah, exactly.
And now I can move on.
Yeah, and she doesn't care who he is or what he's doing.
But now she could just always paint him as the bad guy.
Oh, 100%. And then also, like, she can continue to have sex with that random man that is his friend, in quotations, without any consequence. But now she has to, like, be a single woman, and that's, like, a whole other thing. I don't even know.
Yeah.
But ultimately, what I'm going to be covering in my section is less about, like, Patrick Bateman himself, but more, like, the people who idolize him, as well as, like, I guess the rich white men that maybe he embodies in a lot of ways. So the film is a commentary on the many things, or on many things, but most glaringly the ego of rich white men who have never experienced consequences for their actions and struggle to grasp reality, or like what right and wrong is, or like what, who they are, or what it is to exist and be a person. So there's a lot to be said just specifically about like what this is saying about male ego, but specifically white male ego, and it's more specifically rich white men male ego.
Yeah.
So basically, the world of American capitalism rewards men who act like Patrick Bateman, or at the very least protects them after they've committed heinous and blatant atrocities. They're going to clean up that house. 100%. They're like, no murder took place. What do you mean? You can't be a murderer. Everyone needs to think you're just a nice guy.
Yeah. It's like, those weren't people. That was the help.
Yeah. Rich people don't do bad stuff. They're the pillars of morality, friends. So the character of Patrick Bateman, in the unfunny element of it, like, he's a joke of a man in the film, but like the who he represents in real life is actually what's scary. So he embodies these intersections between consumerism, capitalism, white supremacy, and toxic masculinity. So like the real men that exist, like the one that's mentioned many times throughout the film, Donald Trump, are the scary ones, because like they're the ones actually out there doing horrible stuff and not getting consequences at all for those actions. So in an article titled "How Money Changes the Way You Think and Feel," I basically found a bunch of stuff that talks about how wealth influences the human brain and how it further disconnects people from each other. And their capacity for empathy, happiness, et cetera, as well as genuine like human connection, because what the things you have to do to become a rich person, specifically in America, detach you from genuine human connection, because what's rewarded is inauthenticity instead of authenticity. So in this article on Berkeley.edu's Greater Good magazine, they outline the ways wealth impacts the human mind. The article outlines that because of the privileges that wealth affords, wealthy people generally have less empathy for their fellow human, have clouded moral judgment, are more likely to exhibit addictive behavior, more likely to pursue additional wealth and like luxury items at a compulsive level, that children who grow up wealthy are often more anxious, depressed, and isolated emotionally, and that in general, wealthy people experience social isolation, and that the achievement of economic success oftentimes brings people further from happiness and genuine love. The lack of empathy ties back to the absence of the need to depend on other humans for their basic everyday survival. Operating in a lower social economic bracket often necessitates it takes a village mentality. It necessitates connection to other human beings for survival, and therefore makes people more aware of what other humans are doing. So working with your fellow human to achieve survival and safety. Money removes that necessity for dependence, and because of this, the acknowledgement of others fundamentally changes. It's more observational and less survival. So you get the man who's in the house covered in plastic and he's like, I'm safe.
Yeah.
I am me. Nothing else exists but me. You know, in his mind, he's just like floating through the air, just screaming me, you know? So understanding the facial expressions, body cues, and other physical indicators of the environment around them and their safety are not relevant for wealthy individuals who, because of their wealth, are not faced with the active threat of death. They're not actively worrying, like, if they're going to be unhoused, you know?
And the influence, and they can live forever, you know? Like, they have the money to be able to extend their life,
literally. Yeah, they don't have to deal with, like, common illnesses, because they have the money to pay for all the medicines or whatever, or, like, the cutting-edge new technology or whatever.
Yeah, we saw that with COVID.
Right? Yeah, like... That's a whole thing. So the influence of wealth also changes our understandings of like needs versus wants, because you are not in this like fight or flight need for survival mentality. Your prioritization of like what you need versus what you want are going to be more superficial. You're not going to be like, oh, I need to find food. You're going to be like, oh, my business card needs to be ivory with a specific indentation, because that's the most important thing in the entire world, because like their concept of like existence does not prioritize survival. Essentially it's about superficial stuff. So this detaches them further from the understanding of other humans whose actions are more motivated by survival instead of indulgence. The article goes on to say a lot of what we see is a baseline orientation that lower class individuals to be more empathetic and upper class to be less so. This co-author Michael Cross told Time that lower class environments are much different from upper class environments. Lower class individuals have to respond to chronic respond chronically to a number of vulnerabilities and social threats. You really need to depend on others so that they will tell you if a social threat or opportunity is coming. And that makes you more perceptive to other people's emotions. Psychologists who study the impact of wealth and inequity on human behavior have found that money can powerfully influence our thoughts and actions in ways that are often we're not aware of. No matter our economic circumstances, the UC Berkeley research found that even fake money can make people behave with less regard for others.
Okay, all money is fake.
Yes. But they're talking about like monopoly money.
Yeah.
But yes, money isn't real. Totally valid. But researchers observed that when two students played Monopoly, one having been given a great deal more Monopoly money than the other, the wealthier player immediately expressed initial discomfort, but then went on to act aggressively, taking up more space and moving his pieces more loudly, and even taunting the other player with less money.
I've always hated playing Monopoly. It was my least.
Same.
It's never been fun for me. I was like, I don't like this.
I don't like Monopoly either.
This is a bad game.
And it's like a whole thing too, because it's like it's such a pillar of like you're growing up like in society. People are like, let's play Monopoly. I'm like, that sounds like the one. It's like the longest game ever.
Yeah.
Two, you're constantly like, why? Why are you doing any of it? None of it matters.
Yeah. Like, why if I have to pay rent now, why do I want to pretend to keep paying rent other places? Like, I don't want to do that.
And, like, someone steps on my property, I have to penalize. It's, like, a whole weird time. I've never really liked Monopoly. I find it really odd.
It was created to not be as cool as it is. Like, it was created to be, like, a Monopoly is a bad thing to have. And everyone's like, I love this.
Yeah, let's.
I love this.
This gives me a taste of what it could be. I don't know. It's a whole thing.
Yeah, like, all the colonizer games. I can't.
I know. When I discovered that my previous love of, what's the game called? Oh my goodness.
Catan.
It's just probably my ancestral desire to colonize. I was like, no, I can't ever play this game again. Because, ouch.
I can't play any of them. Yeah. Any of them.
No, because it's so real. And I like didn't even think about it that way. And once I saw it, I could never unsee it. So it's just what it is.
But
in another article that covers the same Monopoly experiment, they elaborate that the root cause of social aggression that took place in that experiment, and in general, when wealthy people receive more wealth, can be explained by the theory called social class essentialism, which is like a fancy word that basically is the rationalization that humans might grasp for when trying to understand their surroundings and why they were given so much more and other people so much less. So essentially, the article I learned this term from was called How Money Affects the Psychology of the Extremely Rich on Swaddle. In essence, it's Patrick Bateman's whole deal. When applied to inherently racist capitalistic system, it kind of compounds in that you're just like, oh wow, I see why it's so dangerous for wealthy people to not have empathy, because like it's so much harm and bigotry and hatred can stem from that.
Because they have with the money they have the power to actually do harm.
Mm-hmm.
Based on those ideas,
and if their whole concept of what reality is that they are superior and everyone else is less. Ugh. Because of inherent characteristics. So I'm going to give you the whole definition of what social class essentialism is. But it refers to the belief that social classes or economic classes are inherently fixed and unchangeable, with inherent characteristics and traits associated with each class. It suggests that individual social class positions are determined by their innate qualities, abilities, or inherent characteristics, rather than external factors such as social structures, economic opportunities, or systemic inequities. It is a white supremacist viewpoint that fed into the toxic consumer culture of the 1980s and led to the I Don't See Color movement of the 90s and early 2000s. It is the reason for the nonsensical rant Bateman delivers before murdering the unhoused man in the film. And in this rant, it is clear that Bateman believes wholeheartedly in social class essentialism. He believes he is God and that everyone else who is of a lower social class deserves to be there because they're not working hard enough. They're not getting a job. They're not trying. Mm-hmm. And he is just the pinnacle of existence. So when applied to social class, essentialism assumes that people's class positions are predetermined by their essential nature. So like, you can't escape it. It is forever. So some of these things that they list are intelligence, talent, work ethic, or inherent qualities. So basically whatever class you're in means, so if you're poor, you don't work hard, you're not smart, et cetera. If you're rich, you're the smartest in town, you're so talented, you just work really, really hard. You earned your status. But yeah, also, you are divinely gifted your status because you're great.
This is exactly Elon Musk. Because he is not intelligent. He literally just has money, dirty, awful money, and then he sweeps in and takes somebody else's credit every single time. That's all he is.
Yeah. Yeah. Gross. So when it applied to the egos of rich white men in believing they are inherently or divinely given power, wealth, and status they enjoy, inversely, everyone else placed elsewhere are there because they are less. And this understanding of wealth and how it impacts the human brain even further validates the fact that trickle-down economics would never work in practice because there has to be care at the top for those at the bottom, which wealth removes on a scientific level. So also, if they believe that their class position is fixed and unalterable, they have no incentive to want to help others rise to meet them. It is a very socially isolating and like cyclical and perpetual thing. This viewpoint often implies that social mobility or movement between social classes is limited or impossible because it disregards the impact of external factors such as education, economic policies, structural inequities, and historical circumstances that shape class divisions. It suggests that individuals of lower classes are inherently deficient or lacking the qualities necessary to move up in society, while those in higher classes are inherently superior and deserving of their privileges. This is not to say that like literally every single rich person believes in social class essentialism, but that they are because of social isolation, privilege, and lack of meaningful connection to others outside their class, more likely to struggle with wanting to support others, having empathy for others. And as humans, we are programmed to try to understand our surroundings. The belief in social class essentialism is a way for wealthy humans to rationalize their surroundings, behaviors in a world they live in, with the understanding that they think it's fair and just, which there's a whole other theory of self that's actually covered in the article I mentioned above that says that humans are like inherently more likely to think that the world around them is just or fair. So they will attempt to rationalize the things that literally aren't just or fair as there's a reason for it, to like rationalize that it ultimately is just or fair.
Like an outlier is the reason that's happening.
Yeah, exactly. It's totally negates and neglects the fact that systemic things take place, that there's racism, that there's sexism, that there's all these other things, because then they'd have to like face the fact that one, they have to sacrifice their position. It's not divinely given. Two, they're going to have to be uncomfy. Three, that like they're not the best thing that's ever hit the planet. And that like their entire way of being was for no good reason. You know, like all the harm that they did, they'll have to actually face that.
Yeah. Just like the platform.
Yeah. Which is inconvenient. So they don't want to. But looping back to the article titled How Money Changes the Way You Think and Feel, Bateman's sense of entitlement is given a bit more context. His pursuits are him just taking what is he feels he's entitled to, like the reservation at that restaurant that all the rich white men love, or his obsession with having the most luxury items, the most expensive apartment, among other things. And his pursuits of these things further detach him from ethical choices and care for others. So looping back to the UC Berkeley study, they found that in San Francisco, where the law requires that cars stop at crosswalks for pedestrians to pass, drivers in luxury cars were four times more likely than others to more likely than people with less expensive vehicles to stop and allow pedestrians to find the right of way, seemingly sending the message that they felt they were above the law. And they were also more likely to cut off other drivers. Another study suggested that merely thinking about money could lead to unethical behavior. Specifically, researchers from Harvard and the University of Utah found that study participants were more likely to lie or behave immorally after being exposed to money-related words. Which is just really interesting.
That is so funny.
Yeah. They're like, oh,
someone's like taxes. And they're like, ooh, I did not do this thing.
Yeah. I want the fake or the illusion of wealth. So sure. Yeah, we're going to be bad.
So funny.
And they said even if we are well-intentioned, even if we think we know right from wrong, there may be factors influencing our decisions and behaviors that we're not aware of. Unconscious biases. So the University of Utah Associate Management Professor Kristen Smith Crowe basically outlined that unconscious biases are like scientific, ultimately. So now to tie in some of the toxic masculinity, Gabe honestly covered a lot of it, but if we're defining what toxic masculinity is, it's a set of attitudes and way of behaving stereotypically associated with or expected from men regarded as having negative impact on men and society as a whole. So patriarchy, masculinity, et cetera. So under toxic masculinity, men are expected to exhibit toughness. This is the notion that men should be physically strong, emotionally callous, and behaviorally aggressive. Anti-femininity, this involves the idea that men should reject anything that is considered to be feminine, such as showing emotion or accepting help, as well as like humanizing women. Power, this is the assumption that men just must work towards obtaining power and status, social and financial, so that they can gain respect from others for social acceptance. So the intersection that Bateman deals with, this is his own perception of masculinity, is inherently tied and intersects with his whiteness and his class. Because of his status, his perception of masculinity is tied to his wealth and his idea of what society expects from other white men like him. That's why he's a clone. And he struggles with the two ideas of fitting in and being remembered, and cloning himself to fit the expectations and the approval of the other white men around him. He becomes obsessed with having the exact same privileges, but like being on top. You know, having the power. And as Gabe said, his collection of blonde women is like a whole thing, because he doesn't care about the women at all, or the fact that he doesn't even care that they exist. He just wants to have power over the other men around him, or gain approval from the other men around him by being like, look at this blonde woman that I have found, or you have a blonde woman, I will take her, and that proves I am better. So all of this kind of ties back to the fact that like men who are operating under the similar wants of Bateman are doing so because of what society has like said that they're supposed to want and are supposed to be, and that it ultimately does harm them, because at the end of the day he is a ridiculous man who is deeply unhappy, deeply angry, and never gets to like find who he could have been if mm-hmm. not for all of those things. And like he has no depth, because depth is not what the people around him want. At any point where he actually communicates genuinely, they all look at him like he has six heads, and mm-hmm. they're like, no, stop it. That's not, yeah. You've stopped putting on the facade. That's not allowed. No, you have to be random white man number four. You can't be Patrick Bateman. You can't be an original human. You have to be random white man number four. And if you stop being that, the world collapses. Everything that we have tried to build here collapses. So like you don't get the opportunity to be a genuine human at the same time. So yeah. It does inherently harm the men that hold it to such regard. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I also like thinking about his reaction, like his interactions with the women in his life. Like he does that like alpha male thing where he orders for his date, mm-hmm. which is just like super gross, first yeah. of all. It's not cute by any means.
Yeah.
But also that scene where he does order for her, she is notorious, like she's known for being drugged up. Like she's constantly on
The other man's drugs. Wife, yes.
Yes, the other man's partner. I don't know if I don't think they're married yet.
Yeah.
Who also is gay.
Yeah.
That guy was also gay, but he has to be in the closet because he has to uphold himself to a specific
role. You have to be the heteronormative man.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that even that has a whole thing. But she is like passing out at the table. No one has anything to say. No one says anything about it. But we are led to believe that she is always in this state because whenever we see her, she's like this. Mm-hmm. And nobody around them reacts to it. So like, just no one sees each other like at all. And what a lonely existence that is. And that's why I think people, especially with like toxic masculinity, right, is that the alpha males or whatever people who think they are one or want to be one, mm-hmm. and, you know, don't believe in toxic masculinity, like, they don't understand that it hurts them too. Yeah. Right? Like, the fact that Patrick Bateman cannot cry or, you know, talk about his feelings or could allow himself a day where he doesn't have to be perfect is making him also a victim of this same mentality. And that's what happens. Like, you don't have to do that. And that's why, you know, there's a higher rate of, you know, suicide among males, because there's specific containment of who they are and what they're allowed to feel.
Yeah. And happening. If you don't get your emotions out, they bubble up and do bad stuff. It's literally like cortisol leads to all these health problems and stuff too. Like, you know, like it really... it does hurt them inherently. And just going back to the one lady that you were talking about, the whole thing with her is he was just saying how like wonderful she is because she's drugged up all the time. That's why he like, because she didn't talk. She literally fell asleep at the table. And he thought that was like the best thing ever, because then he doesn't have to do anything.
He doesn't have to perform anymore.
Yeah. He literally is performing for the room, sure, but he doesn't have to like perform for her. And it's just like, and that's what's wanted. They don't want people. The whole exchange is not for, you know, to better each other. It's literally like, I must use you as status, but also don't talk. Shh. I order for you. You sit, you sleep. It's excellent. It's the best woman that could exist.
Free and asleep. Mm-hmm. Yeah. 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 I think what a great film. What a great way to end our Horrors of Society series for this year. We were originally going to talk about Drag Me to Hell because we hadn't seen it. And, you know, banks are horrible. But, woof, that is a movie.
Yeah, it was doing a lot. And I guess, even if I think I turned off my media analysis glasses, I don't know if I would have liked it. I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know. It was just like really ridiculous. I don't know.
We tried. And I usually have. We did try.
Yeah. And I mean, we've talked about banks before. I feel like it maybe not at length in terms of how they are very.
Not like predatory lending, but that's not what was happening. It was definitely like misaligned. Like the focus. And I don't know if it changes it. Yeah. What I would say is if that is a film that's of interest to you, I highly recommend you go check out Girl That Scary's episode about it. They're great. They're fun to listen to as well. And they watched it so we don't have to. It's how I feel. Like for once, they took it. And I think that's great. They did another, there's another film that I was going to watch because people were like hype about it. Mm-hmm. And then I caught wind of their feelings on it and another creator. And I was like, oh no, this is a problem. Yeah. This film is very bad. And now I will not watch it because I'm going to protect myself. Yeah. And so very thankful. Definitely check out Girl That's Scary. Follow them on Twitter to get your some of your film information. Because they're a great resource for that.
Yeah. And we did another Horror Society. Look at us do. What's next, Gabe? What's next on the train?
Next, we are, you know, going to the future. We're living in space.
Yeah.
We got new technology. Mm-hmm. We have a new concept of what being is. And despite all of those really fascinating, interesting things, the core message is really sucks to be lower class. Yeah. It really sucks to be minority. It really sucks to not have higher education. It really sucks to not have systemic support for your growth.
It's almost like it's almost like the theory that I talked at length about, the social class essentialism, is wrong. So if you are of wealth and you think that, do some research, because it's not how the world works.
It's not true. And it's so next month and for a little bit we're going to be talking about some science fiction work. Some of it is hopeful, but oftentimes it is just this
doom gloom.
Look at how sad society can be. It's still going to be like a Horrors of Society, because that's kind of like our whole show.
Our whole show is a Horrors of Society series, unless we just kind of do those like random one-offs. But like, also, they always end up looping back to the big
society,
three, big four. I don't know.
It's terrifying.
Yeah, it's scary. That's the whole thing.
Yeah. Mm. So let us know what you think about American Psycho. Tell us about your red flags. If someone says, like, if someone says American Psycho is their favorite film and it's not in the way that I would say it, that's a red flag.
Yeah.
If they say they really love Tyler Durden, they really love Patrick Bateman.
Yeah.
Red flag. Right. Yeah. Same thing.
Like, they order for you, but like you didn't want them to.
Yes.
Red flag.
Red flag.
Like,
red
if it's flag. Not like just because you have a hard time making decisions, it's different. Yeah. But if it's like, oh, you're not allowed to have opinions, that's red flag.
Yeah. He's in Mergers and Acquisitions. Red flag.
Yeah.
I don't know what that is. I don't know what it does. It's a red flag for me. I don't, like, there's no way. I think back to, I've only interacted with like a rich person, like someone who has a comfortable amount of wealth plus like so much more once, like for one little period of time of my life. And it was always such a weird experience for me because it was like, you have so much money and you didn't always have so much money, but you have been so corrupted in the short period of time to have all this money that you're like,
yeah,
why do you think this way? And I just remember this conversation we had where he was like, talking about one of his employees who was pregnant again. Uh-huh. And apparently she has like, this is like her fourth kid or something. And he's like, well, is she going to keep having babies? Like, do you think it's fair that we allow her to still work here when she's going to keep having babies and then need 9 months plus off, like, you know, or whatever amount of time you need off for maternity leave every time? And I was like, yeah,
like, what do you like mean?
That doesn't, what are you like, what, like, it was so like, and he was so confident in like that he was like gonna get me in this like gotcha of like, oh, you think you like you care about women and giving them maternity leave, but what if it's really inconveniencing to me a few times? And I was like, this woman can only have so many children, first of all. And she can only have so many children at a time.
Yeah.
Right? So, like, there are times where she's here. Like, it was just so bonkers to me that he was so convinced that he was going to, like, get me to be like, yeah, you're right. You should fire women on the premise that they can and maybe will have children.
Yeah.
Like, absurd. Never again. I don't want to ever talk to another rich person in my life.
Yeah. I mean, it's the whole thing because it, like, fundamentally changes the way you perceive the world. It's, like, literal science reinforces the fact that there's just something that happens to the brain. It's not inevitable. Like, there are things you can ground yourself with. But if you're not actively seeking that out, like, if you're not keeping yourself in check because you don't think there's any reason to need to be, you're going to lose your sense of self and your connection to other people and, like, what is right and wrong or whatever. Because, like, society operates totally differently up there. And it's gross and kind of very uncomfortable.
Yeah, it becomes like me versus everybody else.
Yeah.
Like, and everybody else is like out to get me. They're no longer like a person.
Yeah.
They're no longer deserving of compassion and understanding.
Yeah.
Everybody's trying to take my money.
100%. And another thing I read in one of the other articles I read was that it was like, if you have any like anxieties or like kind of like insecurities, those will only be amplified by wealth because you get so socially isolated and because like, your connection to others just changes in such a fundamental way that like, if you are paranoid and think that other people are out to get you, you are going to just extra the wealth doesn't erase your problems.
Yeah.
It just kind of amplifies them, honestly.
Yeah. Cause now they have more reason.
Yeah. Cause you have more to lose in your perspective of the situation. Yeah. It's all a thing.
Yeah. That's why a lot of people break up if there is like a wealth situation that happens later. Like they've been married for forever, but then one of them becomes a hoarding dragon of wealth. And so then it was like, screw you, Bezos, I'm going to leave. I'm going to take all this money.
Yeah.
Go live my life. Donate it because money's evil.
Yeah.
I was like, what a win for like society.
Yeah.
What a blessing. Wish him all the unhappiness in the world. And some of the other folks like that. It's just like, it is sick. It's like a sickness. Wealth can be a sickness. And toxic masculinity is a sickness.
Yeah.
Consumerism, materialism.
White supremacy.
White supremacy. Hell yeah. So with that, on that fun note, don't get married.
Delete your kids.
Yeah. That's it. Or they'll nothing be happens sad to kids.
Because you're rich. I don't know.
Oh yeah. Now they don't. Now they can't express emotions properly because they've been rich.
Yeah.
And they have never
had worried. A genuine conversation.
Yeah, because you don't even see your kids.
Yeah.
You're too busy.
Yeah.
Sad. Bye.